The only time I really felt like a member of the ruling class was during those weekends at Chequers. The Master. Prime Minister after Prime Minister had found the remodelled Tudor country house at the foot of the Chiltern Hills in Buckinghamshire a place of indispensable solace and retreat. Margaret Thatcher, hardly a sentimentalist, had fallen in love with Chequers. John Major found it essential. His wife loved its rose gardens, lawns and ancient rooms so much that she wrote a book about them. Later, Tony Blair leafed through its extensive library, had quiet conversations with Princess Diana while walking in its grounds, organised football matches on the back lawn. Prince William had had to play, and resolved to go to war against Saddam Hussein in the grandeur of its long gallery. Some people confused Blair with the Master. Certainly the Master had enjoyed Chequers every bit as much. Ulwin Grimaldi, who was more conscious of the Italian origins of his family than he ever let on in public, rejoiced that the original 12th-century house had been owned by one Elias Scacciario, which made Grimaldi seem almost homely. He had no family to play football with. Romping was alien to his nature. But he much enjoyed the sense of the rose garden, which was visible from his upstairs study. In the almost ridiculously spacious great parlour, with its fine wainscoting and oil paintings, he had gathered his cabinet on several occasions as they tried to discover that elusive but essential quality they were missing, a purpose. They had tried in vain, but Ulwin had found the trying invigorating. Now he hoped that this mysteriously charismatic woman in partnership with a mysterious vicar would help him out. All too often, Ulwin found the underlying theme of Chequers to be discouraging. He was a thoughtful man, and the large collection of Oliver Cromwell memorabilia, including the Lord Protector's death mask and the immaculately bound, untouched yards of memoirs by previous premiers, suggested him the only ways in which his own career was destined to conclude, and perhaps sooner rather than later, either in death or in resignation and unread, remaindered self-justification. Death scared him very much. It had been glibly said that politics was show business for ugly people. Really, Ulwin thought it was tragedy for the modern man, a giant, pitiless stage on which no one normal survived. And there was now a new source of pressure. Here, at Chequers, Ulwin had recently been on the receiving end of no fewer than 4 telephone calls from the President of the United States. Their theme was no surprise to him. The subject had been raised at weekly meetings of the Joint Intelligence Committee for weeks now. Washington's Department of Homeland Security and the CIA were pressing for the signing of a secret memorandum which would pass authorization for surveillance of all British citizens on their own turf to the United States. GCHQ would become what the President called the properly reliable and loyal collaborator of American intelligence. Al-Qaeda, the President said, was a single, flexible enemy with a single ideology and command structure operating around the world. To combat Islamist terrorism, it was necessary that the West become the same. The President had been calm, persuasive, and friendly. There hadn't been the merest hint of the whiff of the ghost of a suggestion of a threat. And yet Ulwin understood perfectly well that he had no choice. Britain, now that she was outside the softly stifling embrace of the EU, found herself very short of friends. The Grimaldi government could not be choosers. Glancing around the lovely old room, birdsong in his ears and the scent of freshly cut grass in his nostrils, Ulwin asked himself what Churchill would have done. He knew the answer. Then he asked himself what the Master would have advised. Ulwin would have been considerably alarmed had he received the news from Sir Anthony Bevins about what the Master was currently up to. But the Bevins memorandum had gone from the FCO straight to the Prime Minister's private office, and his private secretary was another member of the staff at Number 10 who remained loyal to the master. It was the master himself who used to say that in politics, where one most looks for help, there lies the worst of the danger. Curro and Angela had been arguing all the way down from Barker and nearly lost their way shortly before the Chequers gates. Had it been a good idea to bring the boys? Curro, although in general a too tolerant and appeasing figure in their lives, thought not. She hadn't mentioned Nick and Ben to the Prime Minister. He would have made no arrangements. And what would they do? Chequers would be like a musty old National Trust house crammed with things that might be knocked over. Angela, however, was unmoved. The Prime Minister had become an almost ridiculous figure in the country, a limp and bloodless intellectual nobody wanted. He had invited Curro and her not to be kind or flattering, but because he wanted their help. That in itself was flattering enough, but if the price was to put on a few fish fingers and allow the boys to kick a football around outside, he'd find it a price well worth paying. Nick and Ben hadn't been listening from the back seat. They had their earbuds well jammed in. Mrs. Wilkinson, who hated children, was tremendously welcoming as the visitors tramped across the gravel and into the house. She would put on some pasta with cheese sauce, she said. The boys wouldn't necessarily enjoy what she'd got ready for lunch. Sitting around an oval oak table, the adults were served beetroot soup, followed by homemade steak pie with beetroot salad. A sermon in Barker.